At the beginning of the recent attacks in southern Israel, I was asked by several here and in other places, because I write a little blog and people seem to be interested in prophecy and world events and world news, but I was asked by, not that, you know, I mean, they're not looking to me as any real guide or guru of any of this, but at least the question was asked, do you think there's any prophetic significance to the fact that these Hamas attacks happened during the eighth day or last day? Well, I've been following and looking for evidence of fulfillment of Bible prophecy and events in the Middle East, at least since the Yom Kippur War in 1973. And I remember that war happened just before we went to the feast in Minehead, England, and we had one person who was in the church at that time who was present in Jerusalem during that attack. And she actually became a student in Ambassador College. She didn't stay very long, I think for maybe a year, but she came to the feast in Minehead, England, and we certainly wondered about the prophetic implication and the significance of that way, way, way back when, in 1973, maybe a little bit more than people do now because time has gone on and on and on. But my answer to the question, was there any prophetic significance to something happening on the last day, eighth day, in southern Israel, is I don't think so. I mean, it was a time in which there were festivities taking place right next to Gaza, and, you know, these events happened. But a consistent theme in the attacks against the modern nation state of Israel in 1967 and in 1973, and actually throughout the entire modern history of the state of Israel, is that Israel has dispatched with great speed victory in every case against the surrounding nations that have actually come against them since 1948. I mean, it's happened almost within a week's time in each case, each of these attacks. But what we see developing in the Middle East now doesn't seem right now. I could be wrong, so make no doubt about it, because I'm often wrong. It does not seem as though this will have a quick resolution or a quick end for whatever reason. A little known or understood prophecy may be coming into play. And I say maybe because we can all have our ideas and our thoughts and maybe possible speculations about what is happening in the world today regarding Bible prophecy. But we can read the Bible and we can find these prophecies there and explore them, and without necessarily having to come to any concrete conclusion, because sometimes when you come to a concrete conclusion, you've got to go back with a jackhammer and get rid of that. The only problem is I've found that sometimes when people come to concrete conclusions, they're really afraid to take that jackhammer to the concrete conclusion that they've had, because they've reinforced it with steel and rebar and wire and mesh and everything else. And once it gets set, then, boy, that becomes becomes something of an obelisk that they don't want to tackle. The title of the sermon today is The Fall of Jacob and Judah. The Fall of Jacob and Judah. And we'll examine, not enough time to really do this except in a brief way, but we will examine a little known, perhaps little understood prophecy by many outside of the Church of God. Now, for the most part, the nations that surround the modern state of Israel, we've covered this before and you probably looked at it a number of times before, right? There's almost, 750 million people who are of the Islamic faith that surround, if you take into account Egypt and you take into account the greater area of nations that are surrounding the small little nation state of Israel today, they're so overwhelmingly outnumbered. I mean, you've got Egypt, and you've got Iraq, and you've got Iran, and you've got Yemen, and you've got Turkey, and you've got all these nations, many of them very populous, and They hold to a different faith that includes the ideal that they should have the Levant, they should have the entire area that Israel now has, and that their avowed purpose is to drive Israel into the sea. But in the last 30 years, there's been so much war taking place in that area, most of it by the United States of America and having a military presence there, and without, you know, making a judgment on all of that, a lot of those nations have been weakened by all of this warfare that has taken place. So when you've got the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan for a prolonged period of time and having this massive military presence by the United States, those nations don't have as much firepower as the United States does. And quite honestly, the advancement of the Israeli military is right up there, certainly within the top 10 of the ability of a strike force of all nations on the face of the earth, even though they're a very small nation. They have, and this is not very well known, but they have probably, now, you know, maybe my sources could be off, I don't know, but let's put it this way. It is reported that they have 2,000 nuclear warheads. So, technically speaking, they are not a nuclear power, but I think every intelligence agency in the world, most of the world's nations, know that they are a very profound nuclear power on their own, not with American help, but on their own. So what Israel lacks in numbers, they more than make up for in technology, as we'll go into, and you've probably heard that on the news. The fall of Jacob and Judah. It's entirely possible that the conflict with Hamas militants and terrorists and Palestinians could end and hostilities cease. We've seen that happen before. We've seen attacks in Gaza before. We've seen kind of some of the rocket attacks that Israel has launched in retaliation against these militants, which, you know, is really a shame because it hurts a lot of innocent people, and you've seen a lot of that played up in the press as well. A lot of innocent people dying, as well as a lot of people in Israel that died, over 1,000 that died with the on the onset of these attacks. But what we've never seen before is the United States get involved to this extent. I mean, there are two carrier groups in the Mediterranean Sea now, two carrier groups, which includes not only these massive, what are they, the Ford class carriers, nuclear carriers, powered by nuclear engines, which, you know, can go for a long, long time, stay out on the seas for a long, long time. With both of them together, they could take the entire Middle East and render it to glass. I mean, there is so much firepower available with both of these fleets. It is just mind-boggling. Turn to the book of Hosea today. This is a book that will stay in for most of the sermon. There are a few other scriptures I'll bring into play. But either two carrier groups in the Middle East, in the Mediterranean Sea, which I don't think we've ever done before. I could be wrong. I don't think we've gathered them for a purpose, like for the purpose of helping defend Israel and having troops on the ground, apparently, in the nation state of Israel today, American troops on the ground. I think we've ever had that. So it may indicate a change. I don't want to go out on a limb. But either this is a show of force or a determination of the United States to be in this for the long haul. And if there's anything that the United States has been good at, and please don't get the idea that I'm being critical, it's been that we have been really, really good for prolonged wars, almost endless wars in which, like happened in Afghanistan, we end up with egg on our face, leaving $80 billion worth of equipment, making Afghanistan, which is kind of a ragtag little country, one of the most heavily armed military powers in the world because we left planes and aircraft and tanks and guns and everything else, ammunition. Some of that apparently has shown up in Gaza as well, by the way. Hosea 5 and verse 5 says, and this is the little understood or actually even well-known prophecy around which the sermon is built today. The pride of Israel testifies to his face. Now, I'm going to have to stop there and explain this because maybe new listeners, maybe individuals who are not familiar with the term Israel in the Bible, you can hold your place there. And let's take a look, because when most people, and even Bible students, many Bible students today, think of Israel in prophecy, they think of that nation state that is over there in the Middle East today. They don't really understand who Israel is in the modern day. So let's just take a brief detour to Genesis 48, and we'll take a look at a name. And there are interchangeable names that are used in prophecy, in Bible prophecy. Those interchangeable names are Jacob, Israel. Also included in that would be Ephraim, Manasseh. These are the names of individuals and peoples, if you believe in Bible prophecy, that exist in today's world. Now, we all know, and most Bible, even people that don't really know much about the Bible, remember the story about Joseph and his coat of many colors, and Joseph being sold into slavery and being sold to a caravan that took him down to Egypt and being thrown in jail later through his life, and then eventually emerging to the top of the pyramid, so to speak, in the Egyptian hierarchy and actually saving the nation of Egypt and actually saving many of the surrounding nations from starvation with his prudent management of their crops over a period of time, because he understood from a dream that God had given and from a vision that Egypt and the rest of the nations around would go into an area of a time of drought. And after they came out of that, Jacob, who was the father of these many sons, these 12 sons, came down to Egypt. Eventually, you know the story, heartbreaking story, just a very beautiful story in itself and filled with a lot of lessons. But finally, Jacob is reunited with his son, Joseph. Now, Jacob is Israel too, right? Because he wrestled with God and was called an overcomer with God, which is what Israel means. And so when you see Israel and Jacob in Bible prophecy, it's speaking about him and his descendants thousands of years into the future. And so he came down and he wanted to see his son Joseph, and he wanted to converse with him. And he had been separated from this son for a very long time, as you remember. And so he knew what God would have him do, that he would pronounce the blessings that were originally given to Abraham, passed on to Isaac, and then to him, he would pass those on now to his sons. When you look at how he did that, it is phenomenal, as the end of chapter 48 and the beginning of chapter 49 begin to show. And in verse 15, it says that he blessed Joseph and said, God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Now he laid his hands on the sons of Joseph as if they were his own sons. And so you see Joseph, Israel, Jacob, all used interchangeably in Bible prophecy, a key to understanding and actually even researching Bible prophecy. But let my name, that is Israel, be named upon them. And so Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph's sons, would become the inheritors of the greatest of all the promises that would be given to all the tribes of Israel. So, unfortunately, as you do your research, you'll find that a lot of people that study the Bible don't understand the distinction between Judah and Israel. All of Judah is Israel, but not all of Israel is Judah, and they don't understand. And that is why the teaching that was rejected in 1937 in Detroit, Michigan, by the Church of God Seventh Day, and adopted by Radio Church of God, Herbert Armstrong, that of understanding who Israel is such a vital key in understanding Bible prophecy and even understanding the nuance of this one prophecy that we're going through today. In verse 17, well, let me finish the prophecy. Let my name be named upon them, that is, the name of Israel shall be upon the names of Ephraim and Manasseh. So Ephraim, Manasseh, Joseph, Jacob. Basically, in reviewing Bible prophecy, the context helps us to understand exactly who it is that might be spoken of. But since Israel's name is named upon them, they would carry forth and they would have the greatest share of all of these abundant blessings of national greatness that originally were given in Genesis 12 to Abraham. The name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac as well, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now Joseph, the father's sons, had a problem because he saw that the right hand went on the youngest son and left hand on the oldest son. And he said, wait a minute, you got this reversed, you know, that Ephraim's over here, Manasseh's over here, let's change this. No, I know what I'm doing, son. I know what I'm doing. God guided his hands to that particular position. So Ephraim was the youngest son. Like a lot of younger sons, he's always acted like the older one. And kind of is carried through history as well. But as verse 19, his father refused and said, I know. He shall become a people, also shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. So Ephraim, the youngest, we find rose to prominence first. And that's actually, by the way, another little kind of vital unknown key to understanding Bible prophecy is that things that happen over there across the pond in England, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, trends, things that occur in Bible prophecy usually happen first there, come to our shores a little bit later. But anyway, he passed on to these two boys, Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph, the bulk of the share of promises. So notice in Genesis 49, Jacob called his son. That's it. Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. You know, at the end of the time allotted to mankind, what is going to happen to all of you? And he goes through and explains, beginning with Reuben, the firstborn. And by the way, one of the Bible studies we'll be going into after the book of Revelation is a thorough analysis of who and what Israel is. I just couldn't do justice to that in a sermon and all of that. But at any rate, in verse 22, Joseph, including then Ephraim and Manasseh, talks about them in total in terms of the prophecies. And if you read through this, you find out, wow, these guys were separated for greater, more abundant promises than all the other tribes put together, and you would be right. So Joseph, verse 22, is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. His archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bow remained in strength, and his arms and his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob, fulfilling a number of other promises like Amos and others. For there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, by the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lie beneath, and blessings of the breasts and of the womb. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, and they shall be on the head of Joseph and the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. He was separated by the propensity and the multitude of the blessings given to him over Issachar and Zebulun and Gad and Naphtali. But we'll be going through that in the near future. But in Hosea 5 and verse 5, back there now, the pride of Israel testifies to his face. The pride, the arrogance, that which would be at the time of the end, the inability of people or a group of people to see themselves for who they really are and the problems for what they really, the kind of problems that they have. And we've got all kinds of problems in our nations today. Therefore, Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also stumbles with them. So Israel, showing in that sense maybe all of the tribes, and Ephraim is the leading tribe, that they would stumble in their, and because of their iniquity, because of their law breaking. Now, many of the things that have happened in the United States have happened recently prior to this time in Great Britain and Canada and New Zealand and Australia, almost like lockstep. The loss of individual rights. My principle that I mentioned is, it happens there, then it happens here. It's a crime to speak out against almost anything that is not endorsed by the government in Great Britain and her colonies. It's an offense. It's a taking away of a civil right that we've always celebrated makes us different. And yet, in the last 10 years and 15 years, and certainly in the last 5 years, those kinds of rights have begun to evaporate from Ephraim, from the multitude of nations, the colonizing nations, as they were predicted in Genesis. But it also says something, and this is the key. Judah also stumbles with them. Now, Hosea, if you'll remember from our Bible study series, was a prophet who was told to marry a harlot who would be unfaithful to him, the first chapter. He prophesied in the late to middle part, or the early to middle part of the 8th century BC, so in the 700s BC. Actually, near the height of the power of the northern nation, which is often called Samaria, because that's what its capital was, also Israel, and it's referred to in prophecy as sometimes after its largest tribe, Ephraim. They were the most predominant at that time. So when you read this book, that is the book of Hosea, the actions of Hosea's wife mirror those of all of the tribes of Israel collectively. Those who have departed from God, even though they were blessed with the law of God, like all the tribes were, all the 12 tribes, and they reached their pinnacle during the reign of David and Solomon, and then they split. And then they descended into depravity throughout the hundreds of years that would happen. And then first Israel went into captivity, and then 120 years later, approximately, Judah began to go into captivity. So the point that I'm making is, Bible prophecy shows that there will be a time when the descendants of these people go into captivity at the same time, that they fall, that they stumble together in a point, a historical point into the future. And it's thus, it is a very important prophecy for us to understand. Now, prophecy doesn't save you. An understanding of prophecy doesn't save you. An interest in prophecy doesn't save you. I've always thought of prophecy as kind of like a prod. You know, keeps you alert. keeps you awake about what is happening in the world, what the reality of what is going on around us. Is it something that you can rely on and use as a predictor and save yourself? No, no, no. Because nothing can do that. Salvation is not in Bible prophecy. So don't get the wrong idea. My interest in prophecy, maybe I speak about prophecy more than any other minister you've ever heard. Maybe I write about it more than any other minister you've ever heard in the church. But it is not for the purpose of predictive nature or trying to come to an assumption that in some way, if we only understand this so well, we'll be able to avoid all of the calamity. No, 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 no. You got the wrong idea somewhere along the line if that's what you believe that I teach. I don't. Demonstratively not. But it is a prod. And if you do not understand what Genesis 48 and 49 says about Israel, and you don't understand that those people had descendants, you don't understand or believe or even care about the fact that those descendants could be alive today, you are blocked out of probably 95% of all of Bible prophecy and you will not understand it. So that is important to know. And what we originally taught in the United States and British Commonwealth in prophecy is very important, and it is not racist. Wow. I don't know where these ideas come from. People have descendants, you know. Every people, all peoples on earth, their original nations are mentioned in the Bible, and some are Israel and some are not. But they all have descendants that live throughout this present time. So, when you read this book and see what Hosea's wife did, you should come to the conclusion that God is giving that to show us that's what our people have done. That's what our nations have done. That's how they have descended throughout this time. And when the Bible prophecy speaks of Israel, it refers sometimes to all the tribes, no doubt about it, but you let the context help you understand whether it's speaking of exclusively these two sons of Joseph, or if it's speaking about all 12. In Hosea chapter 5 and verse 5, the reference is to a time that points to the future because they didn't stumble together in history. And yet now, we've always seen them, you know, through the time of, you know, like going back to 1918, 1917 with the Balfour Declaration. We've seen the descendants of Joseph, in this sense, Ephraim, in parliament with the world's most powerful nation at that time, at almost the conclusion of World War I, we see a declaration by the United Kingdom to provide for a homeland for the Jews. So they did their part. And then that guarantee of protection has been issued by both nations, and then eventually it happened in 1948. Very interesting, the whole timeline that it's happened. But the respective captivities anciently of these two nations, Israel and Judah, Samaria, Judah, a number of different names, were separated by 120 years. So this indicates to us that there is a time in the future when both will stumble together. It's very often overlooked as a prophecy. It never happened in its original fulfillment, and it is kind of a key to understanding end time events. And since I was asked the question, I thought, yeah, maybe that's on people's minds. It might be a good thing to speak about. The defense and security of the nation of Israel is one of the most highly sophisticated in the entire world. You've heard of the Iron Dome over Israel, right? Has anybody not heard of that? The iron, so-called Iron Dome that is over the nation of Israel. It is a defense system that shoots down incoming missiles and allows the safety of the entire nation state of Israel. And it's been incredibly effective. The United States helped develop some of the technology, and the Israelis are very technologically capable themselves. And so they've had this defense system. They've had other defense measures and counter-security measures that help protect the people. And so it was astounding to many defense analysts to conclude that the attack by Hamas may have been known in advance in the planning stages, planning beginning in Iran, which is a sponsor of Hamas terrorists and also a sponsor of Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon. It was surprising to many analysts that this attack that happened on the last day, the eighth day as we celebrate it, actually could have occurred, because they know these things in advance. We have a member in the Phoenix area that his daughter went into the military, I think at the beginning of the first Gulf War, and she went into the language school in the U.S. Army, which is very, very good and really highly sophisticated, learned Farsi, and her job, if I remember correctly, as he told me, her job was to fly around in some of these communications planes as they flew around the Middle East that did this during the first Gulf War. And to be able, and this was, now we're talking about a technology is over 30 years ago, right? But that was so sophisticated then, they were able to listen to phone conversations and conversations on the ground by the enemy and be able to determine where they were and to be able to take them out before they were able to initiate. And if it was that sophisticated back then, can you imagine what it is like now? So, and Israel is the most highly secured nation in the world, maybe one of the most vulnerable as well to attack because of all of these forces around. But the question some military analysts raise is, how could they not know that this was going to happen in advance? Now, I don't know. I'm not the one raising the question, but if they did know that this attack could happen, and these guys are coming in and entering the airspace on paragliders and stuff like that, and killing up to, with their missiles and bombs and machine guns and everything else, killing like 1,000 Israelis, which would be the equivalent in the United States based on the population size and differential to about 30 or 50,000 Americans being killed at once. How could that happen, they ask. How could that happen unless the pretext for all of these innocent deaths is the desire to go to war, and again against a foe that is, you know, fairly small, but that would be insane, right? That if they knew in advance that this could happen, this attack could happen, and they were in a position to prevent it from happening, and yet allowed it to happen, and innocent people on both sides get killed by the thousands, doesn't that strike you as insane? And I'm not saying that it's true, okay, but what have we seen in the outcome of all of this? Division, and more division. People are lining up. You know, they're taking off their Ukraine flags off their lapels of their suits, and now they're putting Israeli, or maybe they're putting both pins on. I stand with Israel. Okay. Historically, we have always stood with Israel. They have been our ally. They have been our ally in the Middle East, and we have backed them up in so many ways. But we've never sent two carrier groups. We've never sent troops actually to be on the ground in Israel ever. Surrounding nations, sure. Lebanon, etc., Syria. But in many capitals and cities throughout the world, tens of thousands are also demonstrating on behalf of Hamas or the Palestinians, which house a terrorist organization which is determined to wipe Israel off the face of the map. So as a church, and I believe as members, as Christians, we can't take either crazed political side and say, oh, I stand with this or that, because I think, as Bible prophecy shows us, they all can be wrong. And resurrected once again, you've probably heard this. I'm sure you've heard this in the news or by pundits. Resurrected is the wrongful, illegitimate, and don't get me wrong, I'm not against any one group of people, but resurrected once again because of all of this conflict. Isn't it interesting, this wrong concept that God gave the area of Canaan to the Jews, Is there anybody who's heard that recently in recent weeks? No, come on, really, seriously? You haven't heard people say, well, God gave that land to the Jews, they have a rightful... Nobody? Nobody. How about those of you online? My audience today is... I'm questioning you. I'm questioning all of you. Where have you been? No, seriously. Haven't you heard? Okay, here's a Bible map. All right, let me back up here. I failed you. It's my fault. I'm wrong. I'm the one that's bad here. You've never heard people say that God gave this land to the Jews. Forget your own church upbringing and understanding. Haven't you heard people make the claim that God gave this to the Jews? And I'm talking about the people that think that the Jews are interchangeable with Israel. Seriously? Here's a map. That's the Mediterranean Sea. You can't see this, but you can open up your own Bible and probably have maps in the back of it. But this entire area shows, and this particular map is one that shows the time of the 12 tribes, all 12, not just Judah. And when you take a look at what's given to Judah, it's a relatively small postage size stamp of that entire nation, which is about the size of New Jersey anyway. I don't care what you guys think. If you have not raised your hands yet now, I know that there are many people who believe that that ancient land was given to the Jews because they don't make the distinction between Israel and Judah. Okay, whether you think so or not, I am correct. So they use this claim that the Jews were given the entire land of Palestine, which they weren't. They were given a small portion of it. But does it make any difference? Really, when you get down to it, it's not a legitimate biblical claim that could be enforced because the area that God gave to Judah was a very, very small portion of land. It may not be the most important thing in terms of the overall scheme of prophecy because people have been displaced everywhere in the world and moved around, and certainly if there's any place today that has artificial boundaries and barriers and nations that have been created by the British Empire, primarily it is the Middle East. The land of the nation of Jordan is kind of like a crazy looking, you know, it looks like a trapezoid or something from geometry that is there. But it's not as though the descendants of Judah are wholly in that area anyway. I mean, did God give the city of New York to the Jews? At one time, there are more Jews living in the city of New York than lived in all the land of Israel. Let's go to Hosea chapter 5 and verse 1. I'm going to press on even though I've lost my audience and nobody's agreeing with me. I'm going to continue. Hosea 5 and verse 1. Hear this, O priest. Take heed, O house of Israel. Give ear, O house of the king, for yours is the judgment. The first verse in this book that speaks to both Israel and Judah is speaking to the leadership of the nation, which I think that are the ones who are the most responsible parties for bringing the world into conflict. So was this current attack in response a deliberate attempt to even have more war? I kind of think so. As crazy as it sounds, as insane as it sounds, why would rational minds do that? Well, because rational minds really don't always rule, do they? They don't. Can you rule it out altogether? I don't think so. The world economy is in a shambles. Our national economy is in a shambles. And if you watch the mainstream TV news, which I don't recommend, even in many cases you'll find that the traditional news sources show that our national debt is spinning out of control like never before. You have felt the ravages of inflation. Oftentimes they'll fake the numbers. Recently, when they came out with a consumer index report, the powers that be from the central bank, from the Federal Reserve, said, well, the American consumer is very vibrant. The American consumer believes in the economy because they are spending, spending, spending. They are, which of course they are. But the real reason they're spending, spending, spending is because of inflation raging out of control, and they have to spend more and more and more for the basics. And so everything that they have done to try to slow inflation has only increased it, which seems to be a plan. And as the noted political commentary of Gerald Celente says, when all else fails, take them to war. So a lot of people are wondering, why this outbreak in the Middle East, and is it contrived? Let's move on throughout the middle verse of chapter, let's see which one I've interrupted myself. Chapter 5 and verse 1. Chapter 5 of Hosea. Because you have been a snare to Mizpah and a net spread on Tabor, the revolters are... I'm going to check that. I'm going to double check that before I get a lot of high signs. I've got this in my notes, but before I get a lot of... I just want to make sure because... Okay, here we go. Okay, I was right. Hosea 5. The revolters are deeply involved in slaughter. Though I rebuke them all, I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hidden from me. For now, O Ephraim, you commit harlotry. Israel is defiled as the leading nation. And it's only bound to get worse, but the leaders of our nations will not turn to God until it is too late. Eventually, they will. In verse 4, it says, they do not direct their deeds toward turning to their God. In times before of national calamity, at least somebody would speak up and say, hey, it's time to pray. It's time to look to God, even though they didn't know the true God. They do not know the Lord. Turn over to Hosea chapter 8 in verse 14. Hosea 8 and verse 14, haven't hit all of the major problems and implications of this, but this is one of the books that specifically addresses all three groups of people, Judea, Ephraim, Manasseh, which is Israel as a whole. For Israel has forgotten his maker and has built temples. This is interesting. Judah has also multiplied fortified cities. Is that a fulfillment of Bible prophecy? I think so. They're the most heavily defended nation in the entire world. But I will send fire upon his cities, and it shall devour his palaces, which is an apt description, I think, of the modern state of Israel today. Now, one of the byproducts of this current conflict that I see, and I'm not sure that it's going to continue because it is a trend that could reverse, you know, like prophecy is like the waves of the ocean. But you see a rise of anti-Semitism, anti-Jewishness that is happening throughout the world because of the retaliatory strikes against Palestine or the area of Gaza. And it, some of them actually have been false, too. I mean, they claim that Israel bombed a hospital. So this is why you have to really be careful with what is said in the news media. And it turns out they didn't do that. Turns out they didn't bomb a hospital. It was actually a missile that was fired towards Israel, but it exploded in the parking lot of a hospital, knocked some windows out, and that sort of thing. But that was but the first casualty of war is real, true information. So I don't even know who you can trust or where you can go to find what is actually happening. Because of the prophecies of Hosea show us this, that others about this hatred, I believe it's going to extend to the United States. Certainly the United States is not the most popular nation on the face of the earth, based on our determination to be at war almost continually since the late 80s and 1990s. The United States has offered more support in 1967, 1973 wars, and military hardware, and we've sold them our military hardware and our jets and that sort of thing, but our nation hasn't been involved in a conflict with Israel like this before. And it's not even against a nation, per se. Not yet. because they think the sponsors of this terrorism is Iran. So it's not against a nation yet, but it could be, and it could escalate that, and we don't know where this is all going to end up. But now U.S. troops are ready to fight, while at the same time, the president is speaking of bringing Palestinians to the United States. That's just what we need, is a lot more people coming into our nation, right? Turn to Jeremiah chapter 30. Jeremiah 30, I said we'd depart just a little bit from Hosea just a couple of times. In Jeremiah chapter 30, and beginning in verse 3, we read this, "For behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I will bring back from captivity my people Israel and Judah." Again, those things did happen anciently. They did come back separately, but this indicates a time in the future when both these nations will be in captivity. You think, how could that happen? How could that happen? "I will cause them to return to the land that I gave to their fathers, and they shall possess it." So those days are coming. And in verse 4, it says, "Now these are the words that the Lord spoke concerning Israel and Judah." In verse 5, it says, "Thus says the Lord, we have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. Ask now and see whether a man is ever in labor with a child. So why do I see every man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor, and all faces turned pale? Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is like the time, it is the time of Jacob's trouble." Jacob's descendants are on the verge of trouble. Look, there's not going to be any escape from this for Jacob, for Ephraim, for Manasseh, for Israel. This is prophesied to come. It doesn't matter how powerful they are now, because you can go to Amos 5 and you can read that at the peak of the power and the prestige of the people of Israel, the descendants of Jacob, the descendants of Israel, you'll find that at their very peak, they fall. It's a calamitous fall. Encouragingly, though, it says, "But he shall be saved out of it." So God is on the watch. And turn to Zechariah chapter 14, just a couple more scriptures today. Zechariah chapter 14. In verse 1, "Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem." This parallels what we've been going through in Revelation 16 and 17. "To battle against Jerusalem, the city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravaged, half the city shall go into captivity. But the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city." At the time in which things look bleakest, God intervenes with the return of Jesus Christ. "Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And on that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives." This is what we were celebrating, or the beginning, this is the beginning of what we were celebrating just a few weeks ago during the Feast of Tabernacles. God is going to intervene for his people. It says in verse 14 that Judah will also fight at Jerusalem. "And the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be gathered together, gold, silver, and apparel in great abundance." But God is going to allow, if you'll study through the book of Zechariah, you'll see that God is going to allow Judah, the descendants of Judah, to fight against their enemies. And eventually, with God's help, they will prevail. Let's finish up in Hosea chapter 1 and verse 11, Hosea 1 verse 11, again, a book that speaks about all of these groups together. We know what the rest of the book of Zechariah says, that they'll be keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. They'll be worshiping God. All the nations will be brought together to worship God, as we know from many other prophecies. But finishing up in Hosea chapter 1 and verse 11, it says, "Then the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together." This is at the time after captivity. They will be gathered together and appoint for themselves one head. Who do you think that is? The one head is not going to be any human leader. They're going to be looking to God. They're going to be fulfilling the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 2 and Micah 4. They're going to be fulfilling that prophecy by learning to worship the King, Jesus Christ. "And they shall come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel." The recent events in the Middle East do not appear, it's a personal opinion, just take it as such, any specific Bible prophecy. But the trend lines do seem to indicate such. That is, pointing to the time in the future yet when Israel and Judah, when Jacob and Judah together will fall at the same time. One of the five pillars of prophetic understanding, along with the rise of the great power in Europe, the rise of the church in Europe, the events in the Middle East, of course, we've covered today, the destruction and the problems of this nation that we live in today, and of course, the preaching of the gospel is very important because all of these folks deserve a warning witness. So today we've covered a small portion of the reaction that is likely to happen to people of the Jewish faith, but not only them, but to Americans and all of modern Israel, the great commonwealth of nations, basically the English-speaking peoples of the globe. So we'll see perhaps not only a rise in anti-Semitism, but further anti-Americanism. But thankfully, God is going to save mankind from all of this. Thank God.